Ecclesiastes. We'll be in chapter 7. So if you could design your life, let me ask you this. Would you design into it the following items? Charm. Would you make yourself charming? Okay. You decide. Long life. Would you give yourself a long life? Would you give yourself fun and laughter? If you could design it, you know, like life smorgasbord, you know, like you could just go and pick out what you want and create your life. Would you put those things in it? Charm and long life and fun, laughter. How about new experiences, new beginnings that would give you hope and a sense of a positive attitude about good things to come? Would you put those in there? Would you put in wealth? Would you? Would you put in wealth? Yes, okay, good. We have one honest man. Good. See, it sounds unspiritual to say that in church, doesn't it? But it is true, and we would. We would put in wealth. And we would probably gauge the wealth by just a little more than we have now. Wouldn't that be true? Just whatever I have now, just a little more. That would be wealth. How about a clear knowledge of future events? If you could have that, if you could like... Would you like that one? Oh, yeah, right. Well, you see, the purpose of the clear knowledge of future events would be to avoid bad ones. Would that not be the case? I mean, if you could see what was coming in the future, you would just say, well, I'm going to avoid that. We were on a cruise years ago in which we went up and noticed they took the tour of the captain's bridge, and they were showing us all these storms that were out at sea. And we thought, my goodness, there's storms out at sea. And we never saw any of them. And he says, well, the reason you never see any of them is we see them ahead of time. We just go around them, and it's not a problem. Well, we would do that with our lives. Is that not true? Look at that list again. Charm. Long life, lots of fun, new experiences, wealth, and a clear knowledge of future events. So why doesn't God let us do that? Because he's smart. You know, these are the things that we are after, and yet life, most of these things for much of our lives tend to elude us. Now, we may have one or two of them, but we tend to not have them all at once, and we tend to not have them in the quantity that we're looking for or the balance that we're looking for. We look out at our lives and we say, Lord, how am I supposed to deal with a life that doesn't work the way I would have chosen it to work? Well, that's the subject of wisdom literature. In the Bible, the literature called wisdom, which is Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, the book of James, and the book of Job. These books are specifically about that. They're about how to deal with a life that doesn't work all that well. And as a matter of fact, Ecclesiastes gives us, in chapter 7, some of the reasons why these particular things that I just mentioned that we would put into our lives don't come into our lives, at least not in the quantity and at the times that we particularly want them, though we may cry out for them and though he may give them to us in small quantities. They're not there in the ways that we want them. Why? Well, Ecclesiastes tells us. But Ecclesiastes, remember, is the back door to wisdom. Of all the wisdom books, it is the one that comes in the back way. It's the one that comes in by saying, this is what doesn't work, therefore we will learn by contrast. Solomon, when he wrote it, emphasized two words or two concepts in it. One was life, what? Under the sun, meaning life apart from God, life viewed only from the human perspective, and Ecclesiastes views life that way. That's why some people think it's a depressing book, and as a matter of fact, as he writes it, there is a real sense that he looks at it and he says it's all useless, and that brings up the second major concept, the really recurring theme in the book of Ecclesiastes, or one of them, which is futility. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. You know, people say that often. And sometimes people who say, oh, vanity, vanity, all is vanity, they have no idea it's actually in the Bible. It is one of the main themes of Ecclesiastes. Life under the sun is empty and vain. Well, you say, well, what possible good can come from that piece of knowledge? A world of good, because you're coming in the back door to wisdom, you're finding out what doesn't work, and that makes you look in the right directions for what does work. And is that not the way we learn? Do we not learn by finding out what does not work? How many of you actually learn when people give you advice? Advice only works. Oh, good, Mo. Mo raises her hand. She goes, advice only works in this way. at least in my life, people give advice and I go, okay. And then I go out and fall over on my face. And then the advice comes back to me in my mind, in my memory, and then it makes sense. See, we always learn, it seems, through the back door. We always have to learn the hard way. Well, not always. But the wiser we are, you know, the more we can use the front door. But even those of us who think we can really learn from other people's mistakes don't do it really as well as we let on. Very often we have to make our own mistakes, and we learn much more quickly from those. So we learn wisdom from the back door, and that's why Ecclesiastes is far from a inconsequential book. I would guess most of you don't do devotions in Ecclesiastes on a regular basis. Most people don't. They read a few verses of it and they just go, well, there's got to be something more enlightening further on in the Bible, and they go and they pass it up. And the reason is because we don't realize how practical it is. Ecclesiastes is very practical because we do learn through the back door. And once you get past the idea that Solomon could have used a little Prozac, you know, when he was writing the thing, once you get past that and you realize that he's just looking at life under the sun and he's seeing the futility of it, then you can get behind the scenes and learn some really wonderful practical wisdom that actually brings on joy, believe it or not. There is joy to be had from studying the book of Ecclesiastes, strange as it sounds. So what we're going to look at this evening is just chapter 7. I was going to do chapters 7 and 8. I had it all planned out. You know, I was going to do two chapters a night and stuff. But there's a little more that I want to say in chapter 7. So we'll just do chapter 7 this evening. Why does life not turn out the way we want it to turn out, especially with regard to the things I just mentioned that we want to put into our lives, charm and long life and fun and new experiences and wealth and clear knowledge of events in the future? Well, in the first 14 verses, he gives six sort of little proverbs. And by the way, as we move on in Ecclesiastes, we're going to find more and more proverbial sayings. And remember from the book of Proverbs, which we finished not that long ago, that proverbs are often in contrasts, and they're often in hyperbole. They're overstatements. They're quick little things to get you thinking. Wisdom McNuggets, right? Remember we called them that? That's the way proverbs are. Well, you're going to find a lot of proverbial wisdom in Ecclesiastes. It's similar to Proverbs, except it has a bit more of a theme to it, and especially tonight in the first 14 verses. And so what I did is I went through and I mentioned, and if you're a note taker, you want to jot it down, six things in the first 14 verses that are sort of proverbial. I put them in different words. You'll see them in the text. But there's six surprising wisdom realities. Wisdom realities. You know, when you're a kid, you think life, you think you understand life, and it's fairly black and white. Things ought to work this way, things ought to work that way. And then as you grow older, you find out how often they do not work in these ways, and you have to back away from some of your earlier confidences. You have to back away from some of your earlier dogmatism on some issues, and you get firmer in some things, but in others, you have to rethink. Because life surprises us with bits of wisdom. Now, there are six surprising things here. And I worded them specifically because Ecclesiastes and wisdom literature in general wants to word things in surprising ways. And you're going to see what they are is contrast. One thing is better than another. This thing is better than that thing. This thing is better than that thing. And they're surprising. And I'll bet you, as we walk through this, you keep this in your mind, but I'll bet you, the second half of each of these couplets is the thing we would go for. You watch what I say as we go through it. And if you've read the passage, you might know where we're going with it. But the second half is the thing we would go for, yet the first half of the couplet, this thing is better than the other. The thing that is better is a surprise, and it's really what's on God's mind. It's really what he's doing in our life, rather than the thing that we would automatically, kind of logically want in our life. Okay, so let's begin in verse 1, and we'll look for six kind of couplets here. A good name is better than a good perfume or a good ointment. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. And we'll get to the second half of that in a moment. But the first couplet, the first contrast, is right in the first part of verse 1. And it's this: character is more important than charm. See, I want charm. I want to be charming. I want to be good looking. I want to have other people think highly of me, even if they don't know me well. In fact, some people would much prefer not to be known well, because they can actually project a lot of charm. They're quite charming. And what they don't want is anybody to find out that in their character They're not quite as charming as they let on. That's really what he's getting at in the first part of verse 1. A good name, that means character. A good name, that means people know that inside of you there is strength, there is purpose, you are trustworthy. You have a good name. And that is, you know, when you're dealing in life and you're involved long-term in a community, whether it's a church community or a civil community of some sort, you have relationships with other people. About the only thing that matters is your name, really and truly. What other people know of you and your character, this is what really matters. And he says, a good name is better than a good ointment. The Hebrew word can be rendered perfume, and that's really what it means. NIV renders it perfume, which means it's better to be good than smell good. But a lot of people would rather smell good than worry about being good. That's exactly what he's getting at here. But yet God says, I will make you less charming and give you more character. Isn't that interesting? Now, don't get the idea that these things are opposites, so that if you're really rude, that means you must have good character. No. It's better than, it doesn't say that charm is wrong. But here's the deal. People can learn manners. You can learn to chew with your mouth closed. You can learn to, you know, take a shower and use deodorant and comb your hair. I know that sometimes when our kids are growing up, we wonder whether or not they'll learn these things. But they do. You can learn these things. You can teach these things. But you know, it's almost a miracle to see true character change. In fact, one of the things that happens when a person comes to Christ, hopefully, Lord willing, is that their character begins to change, and that's one of the things that actually makes a difference to the other people who know them. They look at you after you come to the Lord, and they say, you know, there's something different about you. And what they're talking about is the name, the character, see, rather than just whether or not you smell good. They're not opposites. You can have a good name and also be charming. But if push comes to shove, look for the character first. That's what he's getting at. And I would guess, again, remember I mentioned that we would, normally the world would go for the second one of these, almost always. We would say, make me charming, rather than say, give me good character. Charm is easy to put on. Character actually happens most often because of pain and tragedy, actually. You know that. We talk a lot about that, you know, and people say that off the cuff, you know. But actually, that is true. People with the most character are very often people who've had the most pain. On the other hand, perfume is easy to buy, and you can pour it on, you know. Character is more important than charm. Now, the next couple of verses, verses 2 through 4, the latter part of verse 1, basically state this. Death is more profound than life. Now watch for this. The day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because this is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. And he means foolish kinds of pleasure. So the point is, death is more profound than life. We would say, give me long life. God would say, however long your life is, bear in mind your death is far more important than your life. Isn't that a strange way to put it? I mean, when was the last time we said to ourselves, it would be better for me to take a stroll in a cemetery this afternoon than to go to a movie? Or to go someplace where fun is being had. It would be better for me to take a stroll in a cemetery and remember my mortality. You know, if you talk to somebody and they say, well, yeah, this afternoon I'm going to go take a stroll in the cemetery and remember my mortality, you know, you're going, whoa, well, you just have fun there, you know, bye. I'm out of here. I'm gone. I'm history. I got enough reality. I don't want to deal with this. And now again, he is not saying that all pleasure is wrong and bad. Remember, that these things we're talking about here are not generally opposites. It's a matter of, if push comes to shove, one of them is actually more important than the other one. And what he's saying is, if you understand death, and you understand that you are mortal, that your life will come to an end, you will have wisdom. You will be able to live your life with a purpose. But if all you do is live for fun, you're wasting it like a fool. That's what he's getting at. And the shock, it's amazing, the shock of realizing that you, as a human being, are mortal, is often worse than the actual grief of losing someone in death. As a pastor, I, of course, counsel all the time in terms of grief. I do a lot of grief counseling. All pastors do. And I can always tell when a family or a person has been shocked by the idea that a family member can die. I can always tell when I'm dealing with a family who's never dealt with death before, never considered this, and never really been prepared emotionally. I'm not saying that if you're prepared, you won't grieve. And I'm not talking about simply the presence of legitimate grief and crying and missing a person. That's all very legitimate, and for godly people, I think, especially. Yet, there's a difference between people who have realized mortality and have seen that life is more than just laughter and have, in a sense, prepared themselves. And usually I find these folks among the solid, mature, long-term believers. And very often among the older ones who've lost a few friends. I've done so many funerals, I've lost track of them. And I'm sort of, I don't know if the famous is the right word, but the word has gotten out that I would rather do a funeral than a wedding. Now, that's not entirely true, okay? So, I'm not the angel of death, you know. But I say that from time to time, not because weddings are not fun or good to do, but because there is such a sense of reality at a funeral. I mean, you can see it. All of the foolishness that often characterizes life is stripped away. And the interesting thing is that if a person has invested their whole life in foolishness, then their whole life is stripped away at that time. And I like reality. The gospel deals with reality. I'm not saying there's never a time for joy, and he's not saying there's never a time for joy. In fact, if you've read Ecclesiastes or any wisdom literature, you know that there is a time for joy. There's a time to enjoy your life and enjoy what God has given you. And party on, dude, in a good way, okay? There's a time for that. But he says, in essence, that's not what life is really about. Life is really about preparing to die. And so that's why, in one way, I'd rather do a funeral than a wedding. Because, and we're going to see another one of these proverbs here in just a moment, but there's something about the end of things that breeds wisdom and insight. There's something about being there at the end. And it's one of the great honors, by the way, of being in the ministry, is to be there at these moments in life when people are thinking beyond just what's fun right now. And ministers get to be involved in that at that level. And it's a wonderful thing. Have you considered the fact that it's more important that you understand how to die than that you understand how to live? And that as this man deals with the very depth of what human life is all about, at the very core of it all is the terminal nature of life under the sun. Have you considered that? Have you considered that for all of the members of your family? Have you thought through the fact that God is sovereign over all of our lives and he can take any one of them anytime? And we need to be prepared in our hearts. Not that we will not grieve, but that we know ahead of time life is temporary. In previous cultures, this was far more real than it is in our culture, where we have so many human mechanisms for avoiding the realities of death. But Ecclesiastes, coming in the back door, says you won't be able to really enjoy your life until you understand that it is a temporary thing. And then when you understand that actually mourning is more profound. Mourning and understanding what mourning is about is more profound than pleasure. Then you'll be able to enjoy real pleasure, because you will not try and expect more from pleasure than it can offer you. Is this making sense? It's heavy stuff. I know it's heavy stuff. But it really is very real, and it's very, very relieving in our hearts to know that. I sometimes do take a stroll in a cemetery. I have an opportunity because I do a lot of graveside services. And so after many of them, probably over half of them, I will just break away from the group and walk around in the cemetery And especially at one particular cemetery in town where a friend of mine is, or where she's not there, actually, but her headstone is there. And I'll walk over always when I do a service at that one. I'll walk down between the trees and I'll find her gravestone. It's a good exercise. It's a really good exercise. He says, death is actually more profound than life, and only when we understand that will we be able to actually enjoy life. Again, don't get me wrong. He is not saying there's no place for pleasure. He's just saying it's not, you don't place it at the very base of all your purposes in life. Here's the third thing. It's in verses 5 through 7. Correction is more valuable than comedy. Correction is more valuable than comedy. Remember when I said, would you have a lot of fun? A lot of laughter in your life. Laughter is good. In fact, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes speak of laughter as being good. However, laughter doesn't usually teach us much. On the other hand, correction very often does. Look at verse 5. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one who listens to the song of fools. For as the crackling of a thorn bush under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. And this too is emptiness. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? It's like you got a pot and you're putting it down where there's a bunch of dry, crackly thorns. And the pot's going down on that, and how much thought do you actually give to the noise that the dry twigs make as they are being crushed by the flower pot that you're putting there to produce some beauty in your yard? How much thought do you give to that noise that is made? He says, that's the laughter of the fool. And he says, that's about what it's worth, is that side noise from something productive being done, the side noise left over that is in the process of being destroyed. That's the laughter of the fool. And he says, actually, it's better to be corrected. Correction is more valuable than comedy. Verse 7, oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. It's crazy making, is the idea. Verse 8, here's the next one. Finishing is better than starting. Finishing is better than starting. And this actually hits back on the idea that I was just alluding to, where sometimes I'd rather do a funeral than a wedding. Finishing, the end of a matter, verse 8, is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than pride or haughtiness of spirit. Don't be eager in your heart to be angry. Anger resides in the bosom of fools. When a person loses their temper, they blow up, and they scream and rant and rave, and make various gestures at one another, as we have ways of communicating anger to one another, right? He says, this is an indicator that this is a fool. This is a fool losing his temper. Raise your hand if you've ever lost your temper. All right, okay, now I feel better. Do not say, why is it that the former days are better than these days? What about the good old days? It's not from wisdom that you're asking about this. Isn't that interesting? Now, look more a little more carefully. How do those verses kind of fit together? Well, what he's saying is that the end of things is better than the beginning of things, because at the end of things, you actually see wisdom. You actually see what has transpired. In the beginning of things, you don't really know. If you don't keep that in mind, you are liable to be angry and frustrated about lots and lots of things. You know, it's interesting. When you're angry and frustrated, it's usually because you're not getting something you want. And that could very well be because you're not trusting the sovereignty of God for the end of things. You see how that connects? The end is actually better than the beginning. A funeral, in a sense, is better than a wedding. Weddings are wonderful, but the two people have no idea what they're doing. And we all know this. It's true. It's true. We are hopeful. We are hopeful and prayerful and glad, and there is great celebration, and it is exciting, and weddings are good, and God has blessed them. But at a funeral, you know the score. You know what has happened. You say, well, that's kind of depressing that he should say this. I'm not sure it's depressing. I think it's just realistic. I think it's just realistic. That's what he's getting at. The end of things. When you're finished, there is an understanding of it. As seniors leaving college and seeing the incoming freshmen all full of hope and healthy and not pale and wan like we were when we graduated after, and not broke yet like we were when we graduated, right? We look at the incoming freshmen, and they're all full of hope and confidence, and we say, just you wait until you're about the end of your sophomore year, and all of that confidence will have been washed away, and you'll start to get reality in your junior year, and in your senior year, you'll realize you really need a master's if you're going to do anything. You know, that's the purpose of letting you know. You get to the end, and you look back, and you go, oh, okay. It's an interesting thing. You get to the end of something, you know about it. And that knowledge is what he's saying is actually better than the hope that was in the beginning. The knowledge of the reality of it is better than the hope that was in the beginning. So let me say a word of encouragement to those of you who are at the end of things. And there are a lot of things to be at the end of, not just life. There's a lot of things in our lives that come to an end. May I encourage you, whatever it may be, to look for that which you are learning as you come to the end of something and to savor it. Don't just press on to the next beginning. Remember I said, do you want a lot of new beginnings in your life? Would you put a lot of new beginnings and exciting things? Before you press on into those, take stock of the things that have come to an end, the closing of certain chapters in your life. I mean, really take some time. Parenting, for instance, your kids moving out? Are you wishing that they would move out? Maybe you'd really look forward to that. But I'm talking about that moment when you're saying, you know, there's a closing of a chapter here. Before you press on to the new thing, which may be in front of you, take stock of the thing which is finished. Because he says there's something to be learned there, and it is a good thing. Ultimately, when we leave here and we are in the Lord's presence, the whole story will be told, and that will be a good thing. So he says, finishing is actually better than starting. And when you know that that's going to happen, it breeds patience in your life, which is why he then talks about the anger that resides in the bosom of fools. And it's also why he says, by the way, in verse 10, don't bother talking about the good old days and complaining, especially about today, because of the good old days. He says, you're not keeping the end in mind. That's what he's saying. You're not realizing that, you know, finishing things is okay. The old days are finished. And besides which, they weren't all that good. If you really think about it, the further back they were, the better they get in our memory. To, you know, have you noticed? And we tend to airbrush them and make them really wonderful. Oh, remember, and you can put in whatever decade you thought was so cool. And you take pictures, and in the pictures, you're all smiling. But were you smiling all the time during that decade? Probably not. You were probably making a lot of the bonehead decisions that have got you in trouble in this decade. Back in that decade, they weren't all that great. It's just a wonderful lapse of memory that we have that lets us only remember the good stuff. So don't complain about the good old days and how bad these days are. Instead, realize that the ending of something is actually better and learn from that. The next thing that we learn is in verses 11 and 12. And that is that wisdom is better than money. Wisdom is better than money. Wisdom, along with an inheritance, is good, verse 11, and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? Wisdom is protection like money is. Money is a form of protection. It can protect you under certain circumstances. But he says there is an advantage that wisdom has and makes it better than money. Wisdom can preserve the life of its possessor. Implied, money can't. And that's true. That is true. Wisdom, if you have it, can really allow your life to be much better. On the other hand, money very often has the opposite effect. People very often who come into large sums of money end up ruining their lives with it. And so what he says is, he's not saying poverty is spiritual. By the way, the Bible never says poverty is spiritual anywhere. Never says that it's good to be poor if you have the opportunity to have wealth. It is better to not have any. It doesn't say that. What it does say is, wisdom is better than wealth. And when push comes to shove, it's the wisdom that you really want. And the love of wealth will drive you crazy. It is the root of all sorts of evil. It's the love of it. So what he's saying is not that wealth is evil. What he's saying is wisdom is better. You see that how that works in all of these? And if at the beginning of tomorrow, someone, you know, a genie came out, said to you, you can have one of two things. You can either have wisdom or you can win the lottery today. Which would you like? And you'd say, I'd like the wisdom to win the lottery. Can I have them? Can I have wisdom tomorrow? Can I win the lottery today? And you know, we try that. We try to work that out. But you know, if you can have them both, he says, if you can have them both, that's wonderful. Wisdom plus a good inheritance. This is a great asset. This is a good thing. But if you could only have one, always opt for wisdom. Always. And by the way, when wisdom comes by the loss of money, always consider it a good investment. And wisdom comes by the loss of money very often. You learn a lot in your life. And you invest in things and it goes south. And you say, well, I learned some wisdom. Well, it was a good investment. It is always a good investment. And God sometimes will say, you know, I have some wisdom for you. I'm going to take some of your money. So wisdom is better than money. And if what you have tonight is wisdom, and you're thinking, if God really loved me, he'd give me money, think again. Look at what this man is saying. Now remember who said it too. It was Solomon, who had plenty of money. One of the wealthiest men in all history was Solomon. He says wisdom is better than money. Verses 13 and 14. Faith, now get this one. Faith is better than foreknowledge. Foreknowledge would be the ability to see the future. Remember I asked you, if you could see the future, would you want to do it so that you could avoid problems? And sometimes Christians try to view the scriptures even as a sort of a crystal ball, or they sort of treat their walk in the Spirit as if their understanding of the Spirit's work is such that they will always be able to avoid problems because the Holy Spirit will always guide them around the storms if they're only listening carefully. If they're just reading the Spirit's work, you know, then they'll be able to get around all the difficulties. And they forget that in the Spirit, the Lord Jesus told the disciples to get in the boat and go across the Sea of Galilee straight into a storm. See, we Christians love the idea of a crystal ball that would essentially give us the kind of foreknowledge that only God has. And we like to pretend that that is the ability to be guided by God. No, it's not. The ability to be guided by God is the ability to respond to life as it happens. Not see always into the future and make all the decisions that'll make life easy for you. See? So that's what he's getting at. Faith is actually better than foreknowledge. Verse 13, consider the work of God. This is the sovereignty of God. Who is able to straighten what he has bent? You're not able to actually change very much of what God has done. You see the emphasis there? We would love to. We would love to be able to see clearly enough to do that. In the day of prosperity, be happy. That is, you see, it's okay to be happy. When you're having a good day, have a really good day. Cool. Praise God. Get to the end of the day and say, this was a good one. Tomorrow may be a bummer, but today was a good day, and I'm going to love it. In the day of prosperity, whatever that prosperity, whatever form it takes, you know, enjoy it. But in the day of adversity, remember this, God has made one as well as the other. Why? Why did he do that? No. The devil made bad days. God made good days. The devil made bad days. No. He says, understand the sovereignty of God. The devil, by the way, is God's devil. He's on a chain, and God uses him. Okay? The devil does evil things, but never outside of the sovereign purposes of God. Never forget that. And this man, by the way, Solomon, understood that. Despite the fact that he was depressed some of the time, he understood the sovereignty of God. He says, why does he do this? So that humanity may not discover anything that will come after him. What does he mean? He means so that you won't really understand everything about your life. You won't have foreknowledge of what's going to happen, and you won't understand what's going to happen after you're gone. You can only see what you can do now. So what he's getting at is what I just mentioned. Faith is actually better than foreknowledge or omniscience. It is better to actually live trusting the sovereignty and the providence and the purposes of God in the things we cannot control and simply respond to those. It's better to do that than to have this supposedly superhuman knowledge of everything and then being so bummed out when we find out that we don't have that superhuman knowledge and we made a real blunder or a mistake. You know, we get so upset at ourselves because we think, man, if I was a Christian, I just wouldn't have made a mistake like now. You don't have to sin, but sometimes you make an honest mistake. You take a road that's washed out, and you go, man, if I was really walking with God, I wouldn't have taken that road that was washed out. You know, he would have taken me around it. No, not necessarily. See? Faith responding is better than omniscience or foreknowledge. And it's a good thing because though we pretend to know a lot of stuff, the actual fact of the matter is none of us knows really a whole lot more than what's going on right this minute in our lives. We have no idea what will happen tomorrow. And we're a little dim on what happened yesterday. Okay? So it's like today. Today's the day. So respond. Now, in verses 15 to 29, he says two things. I'll tell you what they are and then we'll look at them. He says, basically, he says, what have I learned? This is the answer to what have I learned. Based on these six things, character is more important than charm. Death is more profound than life. Correction is more valuable than comedy. Finishing is better than starting. Wisdom is better than money. And faith is better than foreknowledge. So what have I learned? Two things, verses 15 to 29. First, my examination of life has proved futile. Verse 15, all of my work of trying to figure life out, I still haven't figured it out. You see it? I have seen everything during my lifetime of futility. And there is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Creeps can live a long time, and a lot of good people die young. I can't believe it. It's terrible. Why does this happen? What he's saying is, I've seen a lot of stuff, and I still can't figure out really what makes life happen. And that's one of the messages of Ecclesiastes, is that not that life never works. Remember I mentioned this last time? Not that life never works right, but that it doesn't work right consistently enough for us to not live by faith. It doesn't function by our plans often enough that we can stop trusting God. Does that make sense to you? Nod. Does that make sense? Okay. I know that something's there. He says basically in verse 15, my examination of life has proved futile. Life still seems empty and it's confusing. Good people die young and bad people get old and fat. It's just amazing. And then he goes on, verse 16. Don't be excessive. We'll look at this more carefully in a minute, but just read it with me. Don't be excessively righteous and don't be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Don't let your kids memorize that verse. Verse 17. Don't be excessively wicked. And don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? We'll come back and look at these in a moment because it looks like one thing and it's kind of something else he's getting at. It's good that you should grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Now, but he's not talking about a little wickedness is kind of good for you. So, you know, go ahead and goof up your life a little bit because that's not what he's getting at. We'll come back and it's part of the application. We'll come back and look at this. But the point that I want to make in the first few verses here is that his examination of life has left him with a lot of questions. The next thing you notice is he says, basically, my obsession with wisdom got me nowhere. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. In other words, it's a good thing. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on the earth who continually does good and who never sins. Also, do not take seriously all the words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you, for you've realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. I'll get back to this. Is all part of the final application. Verse 23, he says, I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise. This is his obsession. He says, my obsession with wisdom didn't get me anywhere. My examination of life left me futile, and my obsession with wisdom didn't get me anywhere. I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. Man, the wiser I tried to be, oh, I'm going to be wise today. Do you ever have a day like that? You go, I am going to be wise. I am not going to eat that thing. You know, at the end of the day, Lord, I'm so sorry for eating so much of that. It's like the wiser I tried to be, you know, my discipline. I'm going to do this. He says, it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. Who can discover it? Man, I can't figure it out. I directed my mind to know, to investigate, to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of insanity and madness. And I discovered more bitter than death. the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are chains. Isn't that interesting? He says, I was looking for wisdom, and I was obsessed with finding wisdom. Remember, it's under the sun. It's not wisdom from God. He says, I was obsessed with it. And what he basically admits to in verse 26 is, I got seduced by an unprincipled woman. He got seduced. Well, Solomon had 1,000 women, remember? And so I don't know which one he might have been talking about, or maybe he was talking about all of them. But he said, I got taken advantage of. I was out here looking to find out by experience all that life had, and I discovered, actually, the bitterness of being seduced by someone who was unprincipled. And then he puts in parentheses, one who's pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. And he says, behold, here's what I've discovered. Remember, this obsession with wisdom hasn't done me any good. I've discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation. I've been adding it all up, putting it together. That which I'm seeking, I have not found, meaning true virtue, real wisdom. I've found one man among 1,000, and I found not one woman among all of them. So save your cards and letters. I'll explain this in a moment. Okay? Ooh, the dangerous verse. You know, I read this verse, I thought maybe we should just press on to chapter 8, you know, and leave this alone. He says in verse 29, behold, I found only this, that God made humanity upright, but we have sought out many devices, many ways of goofing up our lives. That's what I've discovered. Now, what he's saying is, I was obsessed with wisdom, and what happened was I got seduced. Now, maybe it's a metaphor for being seduced by the desire for wisdom. Or maybe it's a reality where he has sought to take life in huge chunks, and he was gonna have all that he could have, even in sexual pleasure, and it turned out to ruin his life. Whatever the case may be, he says, my obsession with this kind of wisdom did me no good at all. And then, he says, I wasn't able to find righteous people. I despaired of finding any really good people. Now, in verse 28, what he is saying, this is proverbial wisdom. He's not saying there are no good women. What he's saying is, real wisdom is so rare. And he puts it in this poetic way. 1 in 1,000 among men and none among the women. He's saying it as if to say, you can never find this. That's the idea. He's not saying there are never any wise women, although he did have 1,000 of them, and maybe he actually interviewed them all. I don't know. But I do know it's proverbial, okay? And I do know that it's a contrasting proverbial statement of hyperbole, where he's deliberately overstating it to get his point across. It is so rare to find genuine virtue. It is so rare to find good character. And I've been looking for this, he says. I can't find it. What I have found is that God created us correctly, and we goofed it up. And that is a great verse, verse 29. We've sought out many devices. There's actually a play on words in Hebrew here in these verses, where it says, what we're looking for, basically, we've goofed it up. The very thing we want in life, we found ways to avoid it. Isn't that strange? The thing that people want in life, they find ways to avoid. If you do counseling with people, very often you find folks find ways of avoiding that which they say they want the most. And humans are this way. And virtue is what God has in mind for us, and we find devices, schemes, ways of avoiding it. So let me offer some advice, and I'm going to take the advice out of the whole passage, but specifically looking closely at verses 15 down to verse 22. Four things that I think you can draw from this. You want some straight advice, some positive advice. Four things. Number one, balance yourself, verses 16 to 18. Don't be excessively righteous. Don't be overly wise. And what he's talking about here is the obsession with acting righteous and acting wise. That's what he's getting at. There's no such thing as too much wisdom, but there is such a thing as trying to act too wise. There's no such thing as too much faith in God, but there is such a thing as being too religious, and we know the distinction when you put it that way. You know, there's such a thing as being too churchy. There's such a thing as being obsessed with churchianity, like we would say, and that's not the same as genuine faith. There's no such thing as too much real faith in God, but there is definitely such a thing as being, quote, too religious, and that's what he's warning about. So balance yourself out. You can never be too faithful, but you can be too religious, too enamored of your own wisdom, obsessed. And very often people who are obsessed like that will run hot and cold. You know, they'll be for a period of time, they go, wow, it's like they're really like a meteor, you know, on fire for God. And they burn out just like a meteor, right? And then what happens is they do the other thing. Don't be excessively wicked. It's the overreaction to being super religious. I've tried the religious thing. I'm so mad. I'm so ticked off. It didn't work. I'm going to go and throw myself into sin. Okay? He says, come on, balance your life. Get a life. Balance your life. A lot of folks are, they do. They just run hot and cold. Listen, my friend, you don't want to run hot and cold. You don't want to be really on fire for God about every 6 weeks or about every, even 6 years. What he's saying here is balance your life so that your walk with God has a steady progress to it. And I'm telling you this as a pastor. This is what pastoral work is about. Pastoral work is not essentially about revivals. Revivals are good, but a revival means that the person's dead. If the person is dead, then I have not been doing my job. My job is to keep you from dying, and me too, by teaching the Word of God. So what we're looking for is a stable, ongoing, increasing maturity rather than this this constant up and down and up and down. I'm doing great this year, terrible next year, great the following year, terrible the following year. You don't want it that, even though all of our walks with God tend to have the ups and downs, what you want to look for is balance. And that's what he's getting at. And that's why you can tell what he really wants is no one who fears God the person who fears God comes forth with balance. See? In verse 18. One who fears God comes forth with balance is what he's getting at. So here's the first piece of advice: balance yourself as a Christian. Secondly, pace yourself, verses 19 to 22. Wisdom strengthens a man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there's not a righteous man on the earth who continually does good and who never sins. So don't take so seriously all the words that are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Were you ever sorry that you eavesdropped on somebody? It's like, ooh, I didn't want to hear that. I've learned when people tell me stuff that they say, I've told you this before, but they say, you don't want to know. I said, what's going on? You don't want to know. Okay, fine. I don't want to know. When I was younger, I wanted to know everything. Tell me everything. Now, I don't want to know. If people don't want to tell me, that's fine. And I don't eavesdrop. I don't listen. I just walk by. I plug my ears sometimes. Lest you hear your servant cursing you. And what you'll do is you'll overreact at that point, and you'll forget that you used to curse people too. You used to curse people. Have you worked your way up in the company and now you're in management and you remember not being in management and you remember how before you were in management, you always used to gripe about the management. And now you're in management and you hear people griping. It makes you really mad. Ribble, rabble, rabble, rabble. Don't they understand my pressures I'm under and so on and so forth? No, they don't. So you might as well have a little wobble room for them because you used to be just as bad before you got into this position. And stuff, you complain about people that are younger than you are. What were you like when you were their age? Actually, they're probably miles ahead of where you were. Sometimes I just remind myself when I think about folks that are younger and I think, well, you know what? For all their problems, they're miles ahead of where I was when I was their age. That's a good thing to remember. He says, pace yourself. That's what he's getting at. Pace yourself. Life has this 3 steps forward, 2 steps back that happens in almost everything. There are moments of progress, and then there are these moments when it's not progressing and it looks like it's going backwards. That's what he's getting at here. Nobody is sinless. People goof up, and you're going to hear stuff you don't want to hear, and you're going to have to remind yourself that's the way I was too. You see what he's getting at? So pace your life. Take it in stride and realize again that God knows what he's doing. We'll close with that part. Balance yourself, pace yourself, 2 pieces of good advice, and leave room for people to make a lot of mistakes and expect them to make some mistakes. I know that sometimes people say, oh, you should never expect mistakes. I've discovered if you want to live long, you better expect a lot of mistakes from a lot of people. And you better make room in your life for times when they're going to let you down majorly. And it's still disappointing. And you're going to let yourself down, too. So he says, pace yourself. Don't run the whole race in the first 5 minutes. Here's the third thing. Take responsibility for yourself instead of rationalizing. And that's in that last line, verse 29. We have sought out a lot of devices. Take responsibility for the devices you sought out in order to avoid what you knew was the right thing to do. You know, a lot of times we end up just in denial. Oh, I didn't do that. I never thought that. I never made a bad decision there. Must have been somebody else's. You know, we've been doing that since Adam and Eve. You know, since the garden. The woman thou gavest to be with me, Lord, she gave to me and sinned. And then I sinned. And what did you do, Eve? Oh, the snake that you created, you know. And we've been just doing this all along. One of the things about wisdom literature is it's very, very realistic about take responsibility for your decisions. And if it was a goofy decision, say, that was a goofy decision. I have sought out devices. I wanted something. I went after it. It was a mistake. I'm sorry. I blew it. Learn to get used to that idea of saying that about yourself because it really helps. It'll help you get wisdom a lot quicker. Take responsibility for yourself. That's the third piece of advice. Here's the fourth. Remember, balance yourself, pace yourself, take responsibility for yourself. Here's the fourth one. Let God take hold of your self. Exactly. That last one is two words. Your self. And that's what he's getting at when he says in verse 18, the one who fears God comes forth. And in verse 26, the one who's pleasing to God will escape from this sin that he mentions there. Ecclesiastes stresses the failure of the self to solve the problems. And so you find over and over the way to wisdom. In the back door, again, the way to wisdom is to let God take over. You know, you're never going to completely figure out your life. You are not going to completely figure it out. There's always going to be a lot of mystery to it. There's always going to be stuff that you wish you could do over again and you can't do it over again. There's always going to be decisions that if you could make them again, you'd make them differently, but you learned a lot from them. You learn a lot more from a bad mistake than you do from a dozen good successes. And the whole point is that God's developing our character. So stop trying to completely figure out your life. Ecclesiastes says basically respond to life rather than trying to figure it out, rather than trying to shape it all the time. Shape as much as you can, expect a lot of it to go wrong, and persist in doing what is right even when you cannot figure it out. Even when you can't figure it out, keep doing the only thing you know to do, which is right, and trust that somehow the light's going to come on someday, and you're going to say, okay, Lord, I'm glad I hung in there with you. Sometimes it's all you can do. And that's actually not bad news. That is good news if you realize you don't have to be omniscient. And that's really what this is about. Do you remember the true account of the tiger trainer who was training the tigers under the big tent and the lights went out? He had about six tigers in there on those little stools. The tigers must feel really stupid. I can't figure out how they don't. But anyway, they were sitting in there, and this guy's got the whip, you know, and the lights go out. And he lived through it because the lights came on a while later, but he was in there with those tigers in the dark. And he said afterwards, they said, what did you do? They said, what did you do that got you through that? Because he couldn't see a thing. He said, well, I realized immediately, of course, I was in a lot of danger, but I also realized that though that I knew the tigers could see me because they can practically see in the dark, they didn't know that I couldn't see them. And so I just kept cracking the whip just as if I could see them. And they never knew that I was blind to them. And then when the lights came back on, we went right back on with the show. Now, there are times when the lights are not on in your life and you can't see, but there's certain things you know that are the right thing to do. And so you do those things. And you don't rely on the flesh and go try and figure out how to make your life feel better. You say, Lord, this is all I can do for now. I'm going to keep doing this until the lights come on. That's actually wisdom. And he's developing us as that happens. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for teaching us through the book of Ecclesiastes. We want our character to grow. We know, Lord, our lives are not everything that we would have designed. We would have put things into our lives that would have reduced our character, to be honest, in a lot of ways. And we would take things out of our lives that have been responsible for almost all the character we have. So we thank you, Father, that you are sovereign over us. And we repent of trying to know more than you do. We relax in your grace and in your providence. And we simply ask for the wisdom, Father, to live one day at a time, to enjoy that which is good and enjoyable, but to remember our mortality and to live lives that simply respond in faith to what's going on. We trust you. In Jesus' name, amen.